Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Imagining the Kingdom, How Worship Works, by James K.A. Smith, narrated by Lyle Blaker.
These beauteous forms, through a long absence, have not been to me as is a landscape to a blind man's eye, but oft, in lonely rooms, and mid the din of towns and cities, I have owed to them, in hours of weariness, sensations sweet, felt in the blood, and felt along the heart, and passing even into my purer mind with tranquil restoration. Feelings, too, of unremembered pleasure, such, perhaps, as have no slight or trivial influence on that best portion of a good man's life, his little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Nor less, I trust, to them I may have owed another gift, of aspect more sublime, that blessed mood, in which the burthen of the mystery, in which the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened, that serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on, until the breath of this corporeal frame, and even the motion of our human blood almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul, while with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things. William Wordsworth, from Lines Composed a Few Miles Above Tintern Abbey, 1798.
Preface. Novelists often attest that their characters take on a life of their own. So while the writer begins with a plan, a storyline, character sketches, a sense of the ending to which all of it is headed, the creative process is full of surprises. Not until the novelist is mired in the mess of production could she have known that the protagonist should go there, should meet him, should say that. Creators are not masters of the universe they create. They, too, are recipients of that world and need to follow the path on which they are taken, even if they might have invented it to begin with. In my preface to Desiring the Kingdom, I sketched a program for the Cultural Liturgies trilogy in which volumes 2 and 3 would be scholarly monographs aimed at a narrower, more specialized audience of scholars. The idea was for Volume 1 to provide an accessible overview of the model and argument, and then for Volumes 2 and 3 to be narrow, deep explorations of particular aspects of the argument, philosophical anthropology in Volume 2 and politics in Volume 3. In the 3 years since I completed Desiring the Kingdom, during which I have had a number of opportunities to share and discuss my core argument with a wide range of audiences, I have decided to revise that original plan for a couple of related reasons. First, as it turns out, Desiring the Kingdom was not as accessible as I thought it was. While that first volume may have seemed to me like a relatively popular sketch, as is often the case, scholars are not very good judges at what counts as accessibility. Many of the readers of Desiring the Kingdom perceived it as a challenging academic book, though obviously scholarly colleagues in philosophy and theology saw it differently. A bit whimsical in places, a little imprecise in others. Such is the fate of a hybrid book. Too many footnotes and references to German philosophers to qualify as popular, not enough footnotes and too many creative asides to be properly academic. Nonetheless, I've decided to live in that between space, to inhabit that hybridity, and ultimately to continue in that vein for all of the volumes of the Cultural Liturgies trilogy. I recognize that there is a sense in which Desiring the Kingdom is a hypocritical book, or at least a book at risk of performative contradiction. On the one hand, the book argues that we are primarily, and at root, affective animals, whose worlds are made more by the imagination than by the intellect. That humans are those desiring creatures who live off of stories, narratives, images, and the stuff of poiesis. On the other hand, the book tries to make this case in a didactic way, on a theoretical register,
articulating a philosophical anthropology. Desiring the Kingdom recognized the limits of such a project and tried to navigate its internal tensions by including a number of forays into the arts and literature, with long digressions in which all of this is pictured in novels, films, and poetry. But still, while it might seem ludicrous to even breathe about this in the same sentence with Marcel Proust, I was intrigued to discover that the young Proust faced a similar challenge. In one of his earliest writing projects, before A la recherche du temps perdu, In Search of Lost Time, Proust was up against a similar challenge in terms of genre, working in the cracks between them. In his notebooks around the time he was working on the manuscript that we now know as Contre Sainte-Beuve, Proust would write, "Should I make it a novel or a philosophical study? Am I a novelist?" While it is hard for us to imagine him as anything but a novelist, indeed Proust is perhaps the quintessential novelist, it's interesting to see Proust's vacillation in this regard. He was a writer in search of a form. The themes of Contre Sainte-Beuve show us why, since the work opens with a jarring claim. Every day I set less store on intellect. Proust's particular concern is the limits of intellect with respect to memory, a theme that would dominate In Search of Lost Time. On this account, intellectual reconstructions of the past strip the past of its irreducible poetry. So honoring the past and the uniqueness of memory requires something different, something other than a didactic rehearsal of past facts. But here, Proust runs up against an irony and a tension. Perhaps it will cause surprise that I, who make light of the intellect, should have devoted the following few pages precisely to some of those considerations that intellect, in contradiction to the platitudes that we hear said or read in books, suggests to us. At a time when my days may be numbered, and besides, are we not all in the same case, it is perhaps very frivolous of me to undertake an intellectual exercise. But if the truths of intellect are less precious than those secrets of feeling that I was talking about just now, yet, in one way, they too have their interest. Thus, the reflective artist finds himself in this bind. But perhaps in the course of these pages we may be led, Proust hopes, to realize that it touches on very important intellectual problems, and on what is perhaps for an artist the greatest of all, this relative inferiority of the intellect, which I spoke of at the beginning. Yet all the same, it is intellect we must call on to establish this inferiority. Desiring the Kingdom found itself in a similar jam, putting me in the strange position of making a philosophical argument for relativizing the importance of the intellect, a theoretical argument for delimiting the role of the theoretical attitude. But again, Proust owns up to a productive catch-22 in this regard. If intellect does not deserve the crown of crowns, only intellect is able to award it. And if intellect only ranks second in the hierarchy of virtues, intellect alone is able to proclaim that the first place must be given to instinct. Proust ultimately resolved this tension by writing a novel. While I hope such a project might be in my future, it is not the task of this book. Nonetheless, I do feel compelled to write this volume and the next in a way that is consistent with the central argument of cultural liturgies, and in a form that at least somewhat attests to the centrality of the imagination in my model and argument. As a small gesture in this direction, I have decided to retain the voice and format of Desiring the Kingdom for volumes 2 and 3. Thus, the listener will continue to find exercises that attempt to picture the argument through engagements with literature, film, and poetry, and I have tried generally to retain a voice that has a little more verve than one usually hears in the dreaded scholarly monograph. The second reason for revising the original plan, not consigning volumes 2 and 3 to the narrow irrelevance of scholarly monographs, is simply that there are wider audiences who are now looking for the sequel or sequels to Desiring the Kingdom. So retooling the plan for this volume and the subsequent third volume is largely a matter of gratitude. Desiring the Kingdom found friends in places I wouldn't have anticipated. While it has been widely discussed in Christian higher education and regions of the Theological Academy, I am also grateful that my argument and model have been enthusiastically received by pastors, worship leaders, artists, and Christian educators at the K-12 level. Conversations with these audiences over the past few years have honed my instincts and helped me refine my argument in ways I otherwise would not have. These readers and conversation partners have also helped me to see just how and where the argument of desiring the kingdom hits the ground in ecclesial and pedagogical practice. Indeed, these practitioners are often able to concretize the argument in ways that I cannot. So out of gratitude, and in hopes of keeping them in the conversation, I have decided to retain the format and voice of Volume 1 for the entire trilogy. Because of this, I've provided a brief how-to for listeners from different audiences, with the hope of providing an angle of entry for each. How to listen to this book. Like Desiring the Kingdom, this book is something of a hybrid, pitched between the academy and the church, since its argument is aimed at both. That means, of course, that it's also doomed to fall between the cracks and end up disappointing both, too scholastic for practitioners and too colloquial for scholars. I've decided that I'm willing to risk the ire of both in order to not give up on either. But given that this will pose different challenges for different listeners, permit me to offer a little instructional guide for different, though related, audiences. For practitioners, the ultimate telos of the Cultural Liturgies Project is the renewal of practice, so in many ways practitioners are my ultimate audience. You are Christian educators, pastors, worship leaders, campus ministers, and those involved in worship arts. You are reflective about your ministry and teaching and are open to new models and metaphors and theories. But you are not looking for theory for theory's sake. So, in some ways, this book asks a lot of you. In particular, the first half of the book asks you to wade through expositions of French theorists, Merleau-Ponty and Bourdieu, while I lay the foundations for a liturgical anthropology. I can completely understand if you find yourself at times impatient in this section of the book. However, I do believe the heavy lifting in Part 1 is essential for the more tangible discussion in Part 2. You might look at Part 1 as digging a theoretical well from which we'll then drink in Part 2. Or think of Part 1 as furnishing a theoretical toolbox for reconsidering and reappreciating the how and the why of worship and liturgical formation, and more generally, the implications for Christian education and Christian formation. Both Maurice Merleau-Ponty and Pierre Bourdieu offer theoretical models of habituation and formation that are suggestive, provocative, and at some points poetic. Rather than simply plunder them for juicy quotes, I have provided an exposition of their work that develops the context and big picture of their proposals, which should help you see just how and why I think their work has implications for a vision of Christian formation and education. But feel free to skip the footnotes. I have tried to do a couple of things to help earn your patience in Part 1. First, at various points, I have paused to raise some questions about the implications of Merleau-Ponty and Bourdieu for how we think about the practices of Christian worship. I hope you'll find these to be little rest stops on a long road of theoretical reflection, contemplative pauses for thinking about how a phenomenology of embodiment begins to hit the ground for worship planning and liturgical formation. Consider them promissory notes that are then more fully explored in Part 2. Second, I have continued to employ various creative asides to help illustrate their arguments and theories, drawing on film and literature. I hope these are interspersed such that just as your eyes begin to glaze over from absorbing the intricacies of phenomenology, you'll hit upon a reflection on Rise of the Planet of the Apes that refreshes your energy and attention. Part 2 should then be your section of the book, the place where we'll explore the specific implications of a liturgical anthropology for an understanding of Christian worship and formation. Granted, Part 2 is no how-to manual. While I hope it hews closer to practical concerns, It does so in a reflective mode and with big picture concerns in mind. My goal in Part 2 is to suggest how the philosophical analyses of being in the world in Part 1 reframes how we look at matters of formation and generate a new appreciation of how worship works. This should encourage a new kind of critical concern about the force and formative power of secular liturgies. But it should also encourage a new intentionality about Christian worship and worship planning. In turn, it should generate new intentionality about the shape of a distinctly Christian pedagogy in education. In both cases, I hope the argument and analyses of imagining the kingdom provide further depth and nuance to the central argument of desiring the kingdom. For scholars, this book is decidedly not a scholarly monograph, because of both its tone and its telos, which is ultimately the renewal of Christian practice. Nonetheless, I do think embedded in here are some original, constructive proposals that might advance conversations in philosophy of religion. Indeed, implicit in my argument is a research agenda for both philosophy of religion and sociology of religion. In particular, I would invite scholars to listen to my engagement with Merleau-Ponty as a foray into the continuing conversation between French phenomenology and philosophy of religion. That conversation, which is drawn on the work of Immanuel Levinas, Jacques Derrida, Jean-Luc Marion, and others, has largely been a philosophy of God, concerned with themes of revelation, alterity, transcendence, appearance, and so forth. This is a robust and important trajectory of research. However, it has not fostered a phenomenology of religion, a phenomenological analysis of religious practice. I hope the model sketched here contributes to a growing conversation at the intersection of philosophy and liturgy, perhaps even to the emergence of a philosophy of liturgy. The liturgical anthropology sketched here also has implications for the social sciences, particularly social scientific accounts of religion and religious phenomena. Some of the arguments and analyses here in Imagining the Kingdom could have been distilled in scholarly articles for relevant journals in the Guild, and I may still pursue some trajectories of research in more specialized conversations. But for now, I have chosen to embed the scholarly proposals in this hybrid book. So to my scholarly colleagues, I ask for your patience with some of the asides that follow. I'd ask you to remember that, at points, I have had to forego some qualifications and nuance for the sake of a wider audience. Significant literatures that I have engaged do not appear in the footnotes, including, no doubt, some works you consider essential. I'd like to invite you to listen to this book as a phenomenological exercise in returning to the things themselves, and ask that you evaluate the argument on the basis of what it says rather than what it leaves out. Introduction. A Sentimental Education. On Christian Action. Following Calvin, then, Protestants may insist that ecclesial practices have nothing to do with affecting human justification, everything to do with human sanctification, and, most important, everything to do with divine agency and power. Picturing the end of worship. As a child, he couldn't wait for church to be over. The beginning of worship was, for Andrew, merely a T-minus 60 countdown to the end. Indeed, more than once, Walter Mitty-like, he launched into his own reverie as the pastor summoned the congregation with the call to worship. The old, tired formulas of the pastor. The psalmist reminds us of our purpose, calling us to worship, would be replaced in Andrew's imagination with the crackly static of rocket launch transmissions that seemed to be conducted inside tin cans. Apollo, where all systems go, over. Roger that, Houston. All systems operational. We are go for launch, over. T-minus 3 minutes to launch. Firing main engines, over. Roger that, Houston. We are all systems go, over. T-minus 1 minute to launch. Stand by for ignition. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition. We have liftoff. If he was lucky, Andrew would emerge from his NASA fantasy around the time of the offering. All too often, he came back to Earth just before the moment of confession, which meant he was still T-minus 45 till the end.
Ugh.
The bulletin would then become a checklist, a way to mark the droning passage of time. Confession? Check. Assurance of pardon? Check. Reading of the law? Check. Creed? Check. Pastoral prayer and prayers of the people? Long wait to be able to check that off, as an elder seems to be praying for the entire world. Bible reading? Check. Sermon? Wait for it. Wait for it. Still waiting. Finally, check. We're getting close. Offering. Check. Wait, second offering for benevolence?
Ugh.
Check. Finally. Doxology. We're getting tantalizingly close now. Check. Another prayer. Check. Andrew can now taste it. A hymn. 7 verses. Finally. Check. Here we are. The finish line. T-minus 30 seconds. Everyone stands. The end of worship is in sight. Benediction? Yes! Freedom! Andrew now smirks to himself as he recognizes that caged eagerness in his own 8-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, who practically catapults over him to reach the cookies and juice downstairs. But he himself sees the end of worship very differently now. Far from seeing it as the bursting moment of release into some unfettered freedom, Andrew now realizes that the end of worship is a sending, that the blessing at the conclusion of worship is also a commissioning, and that the end of worship, in terms of its telos and goal, is bound up with what they'll do next. Head out of the door, into the world. We are not released at the conclusion of worship, Andrew thinks to himself. We are not merely free to go, dismissed from some appointment or event. Having been drawn into the life of the triune God through our union with Christ, we are sent. The end of Christian worship comes with a responsibility. Like all those prophetic encounters with the living God, this encounter with the triune God sends one away with a commission and a charge. Go and do in the power of the Spirit as a witness to the risen Christ, inviting your neighbors to become citizens of the coming kingdom. What we've just done in worship is both a rehearsal of the entire history of the world and a rehearsal for kingdom come. The end of Christian worship brings us back to the beginning of creation, to our commissioning in the garden and our deputizing as God's image bearers, those responsible for tending and tilling God's good but now broken creation. The end of worship, Andrew now realizes, is the end of worship. The culmination of Christian worship is its sending ending. In this time of already not yet, the end and goal and telos of worship is being sent from this transformational encounter as God's witnesses and image bearers. Christian worship is not some religious silo for our private refueling that replenishes our inner life. It is not merely some duty we observe in order to keep our eternal ducks in a row. Nor is it some special sequestered experience that fills up a religious compartment in our souls, unhooked from what we do in the world Monday through Friday. Worship isn't a weekly retreat from reality into some escapist enclave. It is our induction into the real world. Worship is the space in which we learn to take the right things for granted precisely so we can bear witness to the world that is to come, and in the power of the Spirit's transformation, labor to make and remake God's world in accord with His desires for creation. We could never hope to entertain such a commission without the empowering work of the Spirit who tangibly meets us in worship. This is why Andrew sees Elizabeth's eagerness for worship to end, and remembers his own youthful eagerness for the same, as an understandable naivete about the burdens of this encounter. In contrast to Elizabeth's sense of sheer liberation from the doldrums, Andrew now experiences the end of worship with a certain sanctified ambivalence, a sort of holy ambiguity. On the one hand, he hungrily receives the gracious announcement of blessing. On the other hand, he senses the responsibility of the commission. This is no cheap grace. This is a space of spirit-filled transformation for the sake of being sent, to go and make disciples, to be witnesses to Jerusalem and Samaria and to the ends of the earth, to take up once again our creational mandate to be God's image-bearers by being culture-makers. When worship ends on Sunday, it spills over into our cultural labor on Monday. And Andrew's only hope and prayer is that by the grace of God and the power of the Spirit, everything that has preceded this sending has, over time, empowered him to be the witness he's sent to be. The end of Christian education and the end of worship. Or, the end of Christian education as the end of worship. The renewal of the Church and the Christian University, a renewal of both Christian worship and Christian education, hinges on an understanding of human beings as liturgical animals, creatures who can't not worship, and who are fundamentally formed by worship practices. The reason such liturgies are so formative is precisely because it is these liturgies, whether Christian or secular, that shape what we love. And we are what we love. The reason for articulating this model of the human person is ultimately to provide an adequate account of Christian action. This begins with grinding a new lens for cultural analysis. Such a liturgical anthropology recalibrates cultural analysis and critique by recognizing the deformative and transformative power of practices, communal, embodied rhythms, rituals, and routines that over time quietly and unconsciously prime and shape our desires and most fundamental longings. And it is recognition of this formative power of liturgical practices that then drives my constructive concern to encourage intentionality about Christian liturgical formation in two key institutions, the Church and the Christian University. Not because these are the only institutions that matter, but because they are unique sites for intentional Christian formation and because they both exist for sending. Students leave a school via commencement, and worshipers leave worship with a blessing and charge, sent into the world for the world. In both cases, we are sent from formation for mission. The focus on the Church and the University is strategic, not exclusive. Both are crucial institutions in the Missio Dei. A Christian university is a hybrid institution. It is simultaneously embedded in two quite different ecosystems. On the one hand, the Christian university is a university, an institution of higher education that is part of a network of colleges and universities engaged in teaching and research. Much of the shape and life of a Christian university reflects this wider sense of what higher education should look like. And accreditation agencies reinforce this aspect of our ecological situation. On the other hand, a Christian university is a Christian institution, which situates it in the ecosystem of the Church and various other institutions of Christian mission. So the Christian University is located at the intersection of at least these two ecosystems. And it is precisely this hybridity that generates the unique mission and task of Christian higher education. This is why, in Desiring the Kingdom, I argued that the mission of the Christian University should be conceived not just in terms of dissemination of information, but also, and more fundamentally, as an exercise in formation. The Christian university does not simply deposit ideas into mind receptacles, thereby providing just enough education to enable credentialing for a job. No, the Christian university offers an education that is formative, a holistic education that not only provides knowledge, but also shapes our fundamental orientation to the world. It is what I'll call, in a slight tweak of Flaubert, a sentimental education. The alumni of Christian universities are sent into God's good but broken world, equipped with new intellectual reservoirs and skills for thinking. But ideally, they are also sent out from the Christian university with new habits and desires and virtues. They will have been habituated to love God and His kingdom, to love God and desire what He wants for creation, and thus engage the world. Indeed, If we are going to teach students rigorously and critically, we must also form them in what Augustine calls the right order of love.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?